Have you ever lost something so deep you figured it was gone forever? I'm Taildragger, and today on The Hangar, I've got a story about a fighter plane buried under 268 feet of solid ice for 50 years, and the crazy folks who dug her out. Pull up a chair. This one's worth your time. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, July 15, 1942. A flight of six P-38 Lightnings and two B-17 Flying Fortresses are heading across the North Atlantic on what they called the Bolero Route. These aren't combat missions, they're ferry flights, bound for the air war in Europe. The squadron's call sign was Tomcat Green, and they're island hopping from Maine to Greenland, to Iceland, and on to England. But the weather has other plans. A massive storm system closes in over the Greenland ice cap. Ceiling drops to nothing, visibility goes to zero. These boys are flying in milk, and one by one, the pilots realize they are not making it to their next fuel stop. They turn around, try to get back to a base on the Greenland coast. No good fuel is running out, so the flight leader makes the call, put them down, right here on the ice cap. Now think about that for a second. Eight aircraft, landing gear down on a glacier. Every single crew member survived. All eight airplanes came down more or less intact. The crews were rescued by dog sled teams. Yes, dog sleds. It was 1942 in Greenland, that's how it worked. But the planes stayed. The army figured they'd come back for them when the weather cleared. They never did. And every year, the Greenland ice cap gets a new layer of snow. 3 feet, 5 feet, sometimes more. The glacier just swallowed those airplanes whole. Year after year, layer after layer, those P-38s and B-17s sank deeper into the ice like stones dropped in cold water. For decades, people knew the planes were out there somewhere. Treasure hunters and warbird guys would sit around at fly-in breakfasts, just like this one, and talk about the lost squadron. But nobody could find them. The ice moves, you see? Glaciers flow. Those airplanes didn't stay where they landed. By the time anyone had the technology to look, the planes had drifted more than 2 miles from the original landing coordinates. Now here's where it gets interesting. In 1981, a guy named Patrick Epps and another fella named Richard Taylor got serious about finding those planes. They were from Atlanta. Epps ran an aviation business at DeKalb Peachtree Airport. Taylor was an aircraft dealer. Both of them were warbird men through and through. They figured with modern radar, they could punch through the ice and locate those airframes. They were right about the radar, wrong about how deep they'd have to go. The first expedition used ground-penetrating radar to sweep the ice cap. They found the planes in 1988. But when the radar came back with the depth reading, everybody's jaw hit the floor. 268 feet. That's a 25-story building under ice. These weren't sitting on the surface waiting to be brushed off. They were entombed in a frozen vault, deeper than most people can imagine. You have to understand what the ice did to these airplanes. It didn't just cover them, it crushed them. The B-17s were pancaked, flattened like somebody stepped on a model, but the P-38s being smaller and more compact, they held up better. One of them held up a lot better. They picked the airplane in the best condition. It was a P-38F Lightning, serial number 41-763, originally flown by a lieutenant named Harry Smith. No combat time, just that one ferry flight that ended on the ice. They named her Glacier Girl. Getting to her was an engineering project that would make your head spin. They couldn't dig a trench, you'd need to move millions of tons of ice. So they invented what they called a super gopher, a thermal meltdown device. Basically, a giant copper coil heated by a circulating glycol solution that melted a shaft straight down through the ice, 4 feet in diameter. They'd melt down, pump the water out, melt some more. 268 feet of this.
When they finally reached the airplane, they found it wasn't flat. She was damaged, yes. The twin booms were bent, the wings were buckled in places, but the core structure was recognizable. She was still a P-38. The glacier had folded her, but it hadn't destroyed her. Now here's the part that separates the dreamers from the doers. They couldn't lift her out in one piece, not from that depth, not through a 4-foot shaft. So they disassembled her, down in the ice. In a cavern they'd melted out at the bottom of the shaft, working in temperatures well below freezing, wearing headlamps, standing in meltwater. These guys took apart a World War II fighter piece by piece. The wings came off, the engines came off. The Allison V-1710 inline engines, each one putting out over 1200 horsepower when they were new. The fuselage was sectioned. Every piece was tagged, numbered, packed into custom cradles, and hauled up that shaft one load at a time. It took multiple expeditions between 1992 and the final recovery. When all the pieces were on the surface, they were loaded onto sleds and dragged across the ice cap to the coast, then shipped by freighter back to the United States. Total recovery costs ran into the millions, but getting her out was only half the story. The restoration happened in Middlesboro, Kentucky, at a facility that Epps and Taylor set up specifically for this airplane. And let me tell you, Glacier Girl was not a bolt-her-back-together project. The ice had done damage that went deep. Corrosion in places you wouldn't expect because the ice wasn't perfectly dry. Structural members that needed to be refabricated from scratch. The team tracked down original Lockheed drawings. They found the technical orders. They sourced parts from P-38 wrecks all over the world. The Allison engines were rebuilt by specialists who knew those power plants intimately. New propeller assemblies, new hydraulics, new instrument panels built to original specs using new old stock gauges where they could find them, reproduction pieces where they couldn't. The twin turbo superchargers were rebuilt. The counter-rotating propellers, one of the P-38's signature features, required a whole education just to get the gear reduction right.
The fuselage was straightened, repaired, reinforced where the ice had bent the longerons. The distinctive twin boom tail was rebuilt, new control cables run throughout, new plexiglass for the canopy, and then the paint. They painted her in the exact scheme she wore when she went down. An olive drab over neutral gray P-38F, with the white star and bar insignia of 1942. She looked exactly like she did the day Lieutenant Smith pointed her nose at Greenland and never made it across, October 26, 2002. Middlesboro, Kentucky. A crowd of warbird enthusiasts, veterans, aviation historians, and the recovery team gathered on the ramp. Glacier Girl's Allison engines coughed, barked, and then settled into that beautiful synchronized hum that only a twin-engine fighter can make. She taxied out under her own power for the first time in 60 years. Test pilot Steve Hinton, one of the most respected warbird pilots in the world, was at the controls. When he pushed the throttles forward and that P-38 broke ground, the crowd lost it. People were crying, grown men, tough old mechanics with grease under their fingernails, standing there with tears running down their faces because they knew what it took. They knew every bolt, every rivet, every midnight argument about whether a piece could be saved or had to be remade. She flew beautifully. Glacier Girl went on to become one of the most famous warbirds in the world. She appeared at air shows across the country. Oshkosh, Sun N Fun Reading. Everywhere she went, people lined up just to stand next to her, just to touch the aluminum that had spent half a century under a glacier. She became a symbol of what warbird restoration really means at its most extreme, not just a rebuild, a resurrection. Now, I want to put something in perspective. There are maybe a dozen airworthy P-38 Lightnings in the world today. Lockheed built nearly 10,000 of them during the war, and almost all of them were scrapped, crashed, or just left to rot at surplus fields after 1945. Every surviving P-38 is precious. But Glacier Girl is something else entirely. She's a time capsule that was literally frozen at the moment. She went to war, preserved, and then brought back by people who refused to let her stay buried.
The effort it took. We're talking about 20 years from the first expedition to first flight. Millions of dollars, hundreds of people, custom-built equipment that had never existed before, all for one airplane. And that's what I love about the warbird community. There's a stubbornness to it, a refusal to accept that these machines are gone. Somebody somewhere is always digging through a barn, scanning a glacier, diving a lake bed, chasing a rumor about a crate in a Pacific Island warehouse. Because every airframe that flies again is a piece of history you can hear and smell and feel shaking the ground beneath your feet.
Glacier Girl lives now at the Lewis Air Legends Collection. She still flies, and every time those Allisons spin up, she's telling you the same story that nothing stays lost forever if somebody cares enough to go find it. Most of what I've shared today comes from reporting by the Smithsonian's Air and Space Magazine, the Lost Squadron Project's own records, and coverage from Warbird Digest over the years. If this story lit a fire under you, there's always more at RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Go find something worth saving. I'll see you next time.